Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, globalization. The word is often used to describe the movement of goods, money, even ideas. But veteran New York Times journalist Jason DePerl wants us to think about something else. People. DePerl calls migration the defining story of the 21st century. With 258 million migrants scattered across the globe, transforming economies, politics, and culture. He tells that story in a new book, A Good Provider is One Who Leaves. In it, he follows three generations of a Filipino family from a slum in Manila to a suburban cul-de-sac outside Houston. Jason DePerl joined me in the studio to share that story and to explain why our country's current conversation about immigration so badly misses the mark. Jason DePerl, it's great to have you here.
Thank you.
So you've known the family at the heart of your book for three decades now.
32 years.
Wow. Tell us a bit about how your relationship began.
I was a young reporter living in Manila. I had an interest in shanty towns and wanted to move in and try to get a more intimate view. I went to a nun who lived and worked in a slum called Leverisa and asked her to help me find a family. I wasn't interested in migration, or I wasn't thinking about migration. I was thinking about poverty in the developing world. But migration was how the family survived. The father of the family I lived with was a guest worker in Saudi Arabia, gone for 2 years at a time. The mother was home raising the kids on the money he sent back. And all five of those kids wound up becoming overseas workers like their father. So they became a vehicle for exploring the rise of global migration.
Tell me about that nun. I was fascinated with her.
Sister Christine Tam was probably the most famous nun in the Philippines. She was a friend of the new president, Cory Aquino. She was on a commission writing a new constitution. I called her up and said I was interested in coming to talk to her about slum poverty. She growled, "Call me back in a couple months. I'm busy." I managed a way to go see her and persuade her to try to approach a family for me, and came back a few days later thinking she would have screened someone to see if they would be interested in taking on a boarder. And instead, she grabbed me and led me through the alleys and auctioned me off on the spot.
What do you mean, auctioned you off?
I knew just enough Tagalog to understand what she was saying, which was she saw the first person she recognized and said, "Hey, this guy wants to move in." And, "Hindi puede, sister. It's not possible. Cannot be." And she did that to the second woman, and the third woman was struck mute. She was too slow to say no. And Sister Christine stalked off and said, "Don't cook him anything special. If he gets sick, too bad," and left me there with Tita Komodos, who became my lifelong friend.
Tell me how old you were at the time.
I was 26.
And you were ready to do this.
I don't know if I was ready to do it. I did it, yeah. It was hard, Diane. It was, in retrospect, it was the best experience of my life. I developed a lifelong friendship with this family, but at the time it was lonely, and I wasn't quite sure where it would go or what the purpose of it was. I thought maybe it'd last a week or two and I'd move on.
Tell me about how you lived with this family. What did it look like?
Tita had a two-room shack, which was pretty large by Leverisa standards. Among the poor people of this shantytown, she would have been in the upper level because her husband was a guest worker overseas. So few of the houses in Leverisa had toilets. Hers did because her husband had been able to add one after he went abroad. He was making 10 times his Manila wage by going to Saudi Arabia. Tita had five kids. She and the kids slept upstairs. She had a couple of relatives who were boarding downstairs, men who had come into Manila to go to school, and I slept on the floor downstairs with the men.
So her husband had already gone to Saudi before you moved in.
He was on his third two-year contract by the time I arrived, so the family was substantially better off. And that's why Sister Christine steered me toward them. When I first talked to her, she said living in Leverisa wouldn't work because Americans need toilets, and most homes in Leverisa don't have them. But Tita's was an exception.
So how did the family receive you?
extraordinarily generously. And Emmett came home, the husband came home 3 or 4 months into my stay. And of course, I was a little nervous how this man would react when he came home and found that some American guy was sleeping on his floor. And I was out of the country when he first came home. When I got back, he had bought me a cake as a welcome home present.
What about food and making food go around for all these people?
Well, I paid room and board to try to make sure I didn't impose a financial burden. But there's a moment I was keeping a journal, and Tita got interested in the fact that I was keeping a journal. So I bought her a notebook, and somewhat to my surprise, she started keeping one too. So really, we were taking notes on each other. And at one point, my journal says, I woke up this morning and Tita had made me a fish head for breakfast. And you know, the first thing I saw when I sat down at the table was this big fish eye looking up at me. And Tita's journal said, I went to the market this morning and bought Jason a fish. He liked it. I'm so happy.
Huh. And what about the children? What were they doing? How old were they at the time?
The oldest was 17, and the youngest was about 5. The one I grew closest to was the middle child, Rosalie. She's the protagonist of the book. She was a 15-year-old schoolgirl when I met her. She's now a 48-year-old mother of 3 and a registered nurse in Houston, outside of Houston.
So she was going to school.
She was in high school at the time, yeah.
She was in high school. Mm-hmm. Were all the children in school?
They were at that time. There had been a time when the family couldn't afford books and uniforms for Rosalie's older sister, and they wanted her to drop out. And she secretly went behind their back to Sister Christine, and Sister Christine gave her the money to stay in school.
Wow. You
know, Tita had a 6th grade education. Emmett had less than that.
I see. It must have been awfully hard for the family to lose the father to Saudi Arabia, even though there was the money to support them coming back.
Rosalie's older sister, Rowena, was born with a congenital heart defect. She almost died as a baby and was sick throughout her life, and the family needed medicine that they couldn't afford. At one point, Emmett, who was a very religious man, got down on his knees and asked God, Lord, either take this child or let me have her. Please make a decision, Lord, whether you're going to let this child live. And God answered in a mysterious way. A few weeks later, Emmett got the job offer in Saudi Arabia at 10 times his Manila wage. So for him, it was a chance to save his daughter's life.
Pretty massive kind of incentive to go to.
For doing exactly the same work. Yeah, he was a pool maintenance man in Manila and he's a pool maintenance man in Saudi Arabia.
So how do people in Manila get recruited to a place as distant as Saudi Arabia?
The Philippines is the country that does the most to encourage people to immigrate, to go overseas. In most places, if someone goes abroad, it's an individual decision. The government doesn't have anything to do with it. The Philippines has set up a bureaucracy to market its workers overseas, to help set up contracts with foreign corporations, to process them. The presidents celebrate them as national heroes for the money they send back. I actually went to the airport once with the Philippine president as she stood on a red carpet and handed out cookies at Christmas to welcome visiting workers back home. Migration is to the Philippines what cars once were to Detroit. It's the civil religion.
It's so interesting. We hear about the immigration from Latin America, but not so much about the Philippines. So when you set about to do your research, why focus on the Philippines?
It really went the other way around. I focused on the family. I didn't set out to write a book about migration. Most reporters start books by saying, I'm interested in this subject. I want to go out and find a family and help explore it, and, which is a perfectly fine way to go about it. I found a family that I was interested in, and it just happened that they led me to the subject of migration. But my initial interest was their dignity and resilience and faith and courage that they showed in the face of just awful developing world poverty. It hadn't sapped their spirit, and it was only after staying in touch for years that my focus shifted to migration. My initial interest was on their grace.
What about other individuals from the Philippines? Do you have a huge migration into the United States from the Philippines?
Yes. The American immigration laws were rewritten in 1965, so this current wave of mass migration we have is a product of that. And for most of the post-1965 period, Filipinos ranked second only to Mexicans among the American immigrant population. They're now fourth behind Mexicans, Chinese, and Indians. But it's a huge population, and it's largely invisible, in part because they assimilate so well. They don't live in ethnic enclaves. They're largely middle class. They're largely English-speaking. They're largely here legally. There's a huge Filipino migration, in large part because the Philippines used to be an American territory. So they're here in large part because we were there.
You talk about the number of Filipinos going to, for example, Saudi Arabia and to many other countries as well. So it's a country that is happy to see its citizens leave?
The Philippine newspapers run hundreds of stories a year about overseas workers. Half of them read like gold rush ads. They're about remittances setting new records, about the condo boom, about all you can buy with the money coming back, and half read like human rights complaints about workers mistreated, left to sleep under bridges, left to sleep with dogs, raped, abused. It's two ideas in one. It's in the mind of every Filipino in exactly that way. When a Filipino goes abroad, she doesn't say, "I'm going to make my fortune." She says, "I'm going to try my luck." That's the idiom. "I'm going to try my luck." The Overseas Welfare Workers Administration, which is the government organization charged with looking out for the well-being of overseas Filipinos, has a logo that combines the sun and the rain.
So how does Saudi Arabia rate as to how it treats its Filipino workers?
Not good.
Not good.
Not good.
What does that mean, not good?
The biggest problems are with domestic workers, who are mostly women and mostly work out of public sight. So Rosalie went as a nurse. For a nurse, things are, the situation is generally safe. You live
she
in dorms.
She was educated.
She was educated. She went as a professional. She worked in a regulated environment. She slept in a dorm. She didn't have any problems. But others in the family went as domestic servants, sometimes men as drivers and sometimes women as maids. There's constantly stories in the Philippine papers about particularly sexual abuse, rape of women, but also workers being cheated out of their jobs, not paid, branded with irons is a thing
you
hear about.
So why do they continue to go?
The alternatives are often worse. It's not that Filipinos don't generally know the risks. That's the point I was trying to make about the logo with the sun and the rain. I mean, everyone recognizes the risks.
And the risks are pretty great then.
Yeah, and so are the risks of poverty, Dan. I mean, the risks of seeing your child die because she doesn't have medicine or going without food. The title of the book is "A Good Provider is One Who Leaves." It came from one of Rosalie's aunts who was living in a Nipa hut with her two children and seeing other people in the family go abroad and be able to come back and build cement block homes. And she turned to her husband and said, "You need to go to Saudi Arabia. A good provider is one who leaves." You know, Diane, when I first started thinking about Rosalie's situation, I had the framework, poor Rosalie, she has to go abroad. From her perspective, it was more, I'm lucky I get to go abroad. Not all the poor can go. It's the upper strata of the poor who can afford to go. You have to be able to get a passport. You have to pass a medical exam. You often have to pay fees to crooked middlemen. People sell their farms. They sell their livestock. They go deep into debt for the chance to go abroad. So Rosalie not only got to go, but she got to go as a nurse, as a professional. So she was quite fortunate in the scheme of things.
So she was treated well. What about her father?
He didn't have any particular problems, but Tita, the mother of the family I lived with, was one of 11 siblings. In her generation, 9 went abroad or had a spouse who did. And then, you know, if you think of 11 siblings in a second generation, there's 45 first cousins on one side of the family, and last count, I think 24 or so had gone abroad. So it's a large extended family, and you know, taken as a whole, just about everything that could happen to a migrant, good or bad, has happened to somebody in the family.
So what's the impact on a home country?
Initially, I was interested in the family alone, but the light bulb moment to me when I discovered the importance of migration in the world was in learning that remittances, the sums that migrants send back to their family, are three times the world's foreign aid budgets combined.
Wow.
So if you're interested in poverty in the developing world, that's the anti-poverty program. Migration is the anti-poverty program. Sometimes conservatives say that poor people need to do more to help themselves. Well, migrants do.
That's what they're doing.
That's what this family was doing.
And
millions like them. So remittances are 10% of the Filipino GDP. I went to the Philippines to do a story for the New York Times on the impact of migration on Philippine culture. And I worried that it might be a little too subtle for an outsider to fully understand. And then I rode past the Philippine Central Bank where the year's remittance tally was strung up in Christmas lights. So it's not subtle. This is a country that is deeply dependent on the money from abroad.
So that money is then taxed by the Philippine government.
No, it's not. It's not taxed as remittances. I mean, it's spent. It's spent on education. It's spent on healthcare. It's spent on housing. So it's infused into the economy and taxed in that sense. But it's the student aid program. If you want to go to college, that's half of the people abroad are sending back money for tuition. It's the housing program and it's the healthcare program.
When we come back, more from Jason DePearl.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now here's the rest of my conversation with Jason DePearl. He is a senior writer at the New York Times and author of the new book titled A Good Provider is One Who Leaves, One Family and Migration in the 21st Century. So Rosalie, the daughter you've talked about, becomes the central figure in this story. Talk about her migration story.
If you were to sit in the shantytown of Leverisa when Rosalie was a teenager and pick the child who was going to make it out of the slum, I don't think you would have picked Rosalie. She had friends who were more academically gifted, more outgoing, seemingly tougher. Rosalie was a B and C student in high school. Nothing showed any particular academic promise, but the line on her transcript that I think most revealed her character wasn't her grades, it was her attendance. In 4 years, she didn't miss a single day.
Huh.
She told me later, the way she put it was, in high school is when I got grit. And she did. And it's a very, very quietly, very quiet persistence. She almost didn't get into nursing school. She almost flunked out of nursing school. She had to take the American nursing test 3 times. She had to take the American English test 5 times. And she just kept going for 20 years and never gave up.
How good was the education she had in the Philippines?
Well, the nursing education is quite good. The reason there are so many Filipino nurses who come to the States is that the U.S. set up the nursing system there in the colonial administration. The Rockefeller Foundation arrived in about 1906 and established the first American nursing school. So they train on an American curriculum, they train in English, and there's been a decades-long migration pipeline established. So virtually every Filipino nurse wants to come to the States. It's a thing. In the current context, there's one other point maybe to keep in mind about her as a nurse, which is that Rosalie didn't take an American job. She went to a hospital in a community that had been hit by a hurricane and was rebuilding. And so many nurses had left Galveston Island, they couldn't lure them back, even with bonuses. So after years of trying, the hospital finally went abroad and hired 20 foreign nurses to come in and open a new ward. So there's a context in which, in the current sort of zero-sum game framing that we sometimes hear about immigration, you know, people, they're taking from Americans. Well, Rosalie didn't take another nurse's job. She filled a job the hospital couldn't fill, and in doing so provided this life-saving care.
So it does make one wonder to what extent that statement about taking jobs from other Americans is really valid.
There's 44 million immigrants in the country. No one family can stand for them all. I think what Rosalie stands for is the substantial part missing from the presidential Twitter feed. There's a lot of different immigration stories out there, and I think we overlook the ones of success like hers.
Now, tell me how much of her income Rosalie was able to send back home.
Depending on where she was and at what point in her career, sometimes more than half. By the time she got to the States, maybe a third or so. She was providing health care for her aging parents. She was sending nieces and nephews to school. Her sister was still sick and couldn't work. She was supporting her. The requests from home are just unrelenting. And one of the things I didn't fully realize until following her so closely is just the amount of guilt that immigrants carry with them, even when they're being very generous to their families, as Rosalie always was. There was always a sense of guilt if she bought something for herself. So even her daughter, who's was 10 or 11, bought a doll and showed it on Skype to one of the relatives back home, and the relative complained, why are you spending the money as you could be sending it to me? It's a little girl with a Barbie. So imagine how Rosalie felt when at the end of the book she buys a house in a suburb of Houston, and it's obviously a source of great pride to her. It's a mark of her achievement in the United States, but she's afraid to tell anybody back home about it because she's ashamed that she has so much more than them. And she's also a little afraid that it'll make them increase their demands for more money. It's a really complicated emotion to have that.
I should say. So you began writing this book before all the negative rhetoric about immigrants actually began. So how has that rhetoric affected your thinking about what's happening regarding immigrants to this country?
Yeah, to the extent I had a framework for it when it first started, it was wondering why immigration hadn't been as contentious in the United States as it had been in other places, legal immigration at least, and trying to think through what was it about American economy, culture, history that made us more receptive or, forgive the word, exceptional. Obviously, that changed somewhere in the middle of the narrative, and I had to reframe the question and wonder why this reaction hadn't happened earlier, why it was happening the way it did, how deep it went, what effect it would have on legal immigrants like Rosalie. I mean, a lot of those questions obviously are still, we won't know the answer for a long time, but it certainly changed the atmosphere around the story, the context for it.
You helped Rosalie to achieve what she finally achieved. Talk about that.
I guess, honestly, I don't know how much of a role our friendship played. There's no control group. I can't look at a Rosalie who didn't have an American journalist come land in her house and wonder if she would have gotten out the same way. I think I encouraged her at times.
You helped her study for her English.
There were times
exam.
When she needed a tutor. I was able to help her at the margins, but I don't want to detract from her own achievement. I think her resilience and her ambition was her own. I mean, my encouragement wouldn't have meant much if she hadn't had the drive
absolutely.
To keep it going. Yeah.
Yeah. But a little helping hand, as it was reached out to you, you then turned and reached out to her.
Well, my relationship with her initially wasn't the arm's length relationship of a journalist and a subject. Right? I didn't encounter her as a New York Times reporter and decide to write about her, and therefore we have kind of a line drawn between us. Before I worked for the New York Times, I was a young journalist. I moved in and we became friends. So, you know, really it was a relationship that didn't have a rule book. There's a moment where this became evident to me right when she was leaving for the United States. She had gotten her visa approved, but she didn't have the visa in hand, the visa, the physical object, the piece of paper. And she was scheduled to leave the next morning. And if she didn't get it that day, she was going to miss her plane. She wouldn't get to Texas in time. She wouldn't be able to start orientation at the new hospital. She, you know, theoretically could have even lost the job. So I had an appointment at the embassy that day with a visa officer, purely as a matter of reporting. I wanted to learn more about the process. And I sat there in the room and thought, well, if I mention something about this, this is hung up in bureaucratically. If I mention something about it, maybe she can loosen and get Rosalie the visa. But I'm not there as an advocate. I'm there as a reporter. So I kind of went back and forth. And even journalistically, I kind of would have been a better story if she didn't get the visa, because it would have been something more interesting and revealing to write about that. For all the talk of open borders, even nurses who are approved for visa, it's not such an open border. But then I thought, Jesus, Rosalie's been trying for 20 years to get to the States.
Maybe. 20 so I, years.
You know, I sat there, wrestled with it for a second, and I mentioned that she hadn't gotten the visa hadn't come yet, and the very kind embassy employee got up and made a phone call, and by the end of the day, she had the visa.
So you do write that President Trump's policies are likely creating this permanent immigrant underclass that everyone fears. Tell me how you see that happening.
So people who are opposed to immigration worry that we're importing a foreign underclass, people who are undocumented with low skills, who won't assimilate into our society, will wind up unemployed and criminal in some way. Well, it seems to me that what we really face is a risk of that becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you have the unprecedented situation that we now have of 11 million people outside the law here for many, many years, most of them, but without the protections of the law and of American society, then, you know, what better way would there be to create an underclass? So, that and the harsh rhetoric of, you know, if you tell people long enough and loudly enough that they're not wanted, they may start to listen to you. So, my hope is that this generation of immigrants, like generations past, will by and large successfully assimilate even the poorest ones. My fear is that the policies of the president are going to make it all the more harder for that to happen.
Jason DePaul, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Diane.
And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Douglas Bell and Natalie Urev-Lefker. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.